study this evening, we're studying from Daniel, the 9th chapter. We're trying to glean some things from this in our study that might be helpful to us in the study of the next portion that we read beginning at verse 24 through verse 27. Some have described the latter portion of this chapter as among some of the most difficult verses that we read about in the Old Testament, the 70 weeks of Daniel. I'm not so persuaded that it ought to be quite as difficult, but admittedly it is a difficult context, and I think that the preface to studying the 70 weeks of Daniel 9, 24 through 27 is to be seen in the things that Daniel prays for in the earlier part of this chapter. So we want to talk about the prayer of Daniel, the prayer of Daniel in Daniel chapter 9. As you read in verse 1, it says, "In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans." Let's just pause there. As we read about this man, the first year of Darius, we've talked about Darius before. Not the first time we've been introduced to Darius. In the 5th chapter at verse 31, we notice that in the 9th, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Darius was the first of the kings to sit on the throne of the Chaldeans following the conquering of the Babylonian Empire. And as we read about Darius, we have studied in other chapters concerning his role to Cyrus. What was the relationship between Darius and Cyrus? Randy?
If I remember correctly, Cyrus was the Persian king, and over the whole kingdom.
All right. Okay, very good. That's a good way to put it. And we've read about Darius, in the 6th chapter rather extensively throughout this chapter. The time frame, the first year of Darius, what time frame does that put this prayer in? Time frames are significant in the book of Daniel, because we're following a timeline. You know it's on the board. Yeah, about 538. Who knew that? Okay, about 538 B.C. The reason for the prayer. In verse 2 it says, "In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books," notice that it's plural, "the number of years whereof the word of Jehovah came to Jeremiah the prophet for the accomplishing of the desolations of Jerusalem, even 70 years." Daniel is familiar with the prophecy of Jeremiah. In Jeremiah chapter 25, we want to remember this. It's going to be important to our study as we progress down the line. In Jeremiah chapter 25, reading beginning at verse 9, verse 8, it says, "Therefore thus saith Jehovah of hosts, because ye have not heard my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith Jehovah, and I will send unto Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land, and against the inhabitants thereof, and against all these nations round about. And I will utterly destroy them, and make them an astonishment, and a hissing, and perpetual desolations. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of myrrh, and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones, and the light of the lamp. And this whole land shall be a desolation, and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Now, as we notice in this context, God was very specific as he spoke to Jeremiah regarding the period of captivity. And he was very specific regarding what would happen to them. As he mentions in the latter part, or the first part of verse 10, all of the sounds of joy among those of the kingdom of Israel would be taken from them. There would be no reason for happiness among them as they would be taken into Babylonian captivity. Daniel is familiar with these Old Testament prophecies. In Jeremiah chapter 29, in verse 10, it says, "For thus saith Jehovah, after 70 years are accomplished for Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place." Interestingly enough, not only was God specific relative to the period of time that they would be taken into captivity, as we see in Jeremiah chapter 25, but He was also very specific regarding a return or a restoration to the land. Now, in the period of restoration, there are a couple of books in the Old Testament that we need to be familiar with that tell us some detail about the restoration. And again, we're trying to get a chronology fixed in our mind. What Old Testament books tell us about the restoration period of the people of Israel? Ezra and Nehemiah. Very good. Ezra and Nehemiah. Now pigeonhole that and remember that those two books tell us about the restoration period of Old Testament Israel. We're going to have occasion tonight in our study to look a little bit more detail into those books, and in particular in Ezra chapter 1 and in Nehemiah chapter 9. But as you turn in your Bibles further, noticing the statement that Daniel makes, "I understood by the books the number of years." Obviously, he was familiar with the prophecies of Jeremiah. But also in the chronology, turn if you will to Isaiah chapters 44 and 45, where Isaiah tells us regarding who would be king. And I think that becomes significant. In Isaiah 44 at verse 29, or 28 beginning, "That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure. Even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Thus saith Jehovah to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him. And I will loose the loins of the kings, to open the doors before him, and the gates shall not be shut." Now who's on the throne at the time Daniel is making this prayer or praying to God? He tells us that Darius is on the throne, but Randy, as you pointed out, who was on the throne over Darius? Cyrus, the king of the Medes and the Persians. Now, when Cyrus came to the throne, do you suppose just by speculation that Daniel was familiar with what Isaiah had said regarding who would be on the throne and could somewhat put a time frame together that it's getting about time for this 70 years to take place, or rather to end? And so Daniel is praying, familiar with these Old Testament prophecies regarding the 70 years from Daniel chapter 2 or chapter 9, verse 2. Now notice, if you will, further, this 70 years, when did it begin? Well, as you'll see on the chart, it began about 606 B.C. with the captivity of Daniel and the first group that was taken into captivity from Jerusalem. In 2 Chronicles, chapter 36. 2 Chronicles, chapter 36. I have to remind myself for a moment. Oh, yes. 2 Chronicles 36, beginning at verse 5. It tells us that Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, his God. Against him came up Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and bound him in fetters to carry him to Babylon. Now in these verses and the verses following, down through verse 7, we read about Babylon being the one who would overcome the people of God, but it would be during the reign of Jehoiakim. And that puts us about the date 606. Now that becomes significant because what time or what date were the first of the captives returned to the land of promise, or the land of Israel? And you remember that chart that we passed out that had a timeline on it back several months ago? And we talked about certain dates that would become significant to our study. And when we learned that the first group was taken captive about 606, when were they returned? The first group returned. About 536. John, do the math for me. That's pretty close to 70 years, isn't it? Now, it's interesting that Jeremiah knew that, and interesting that Isaiah knew that by way of prophecy. Jeremiah prophesying specifically regarding the time of the captivity and the time, or the time that would lapse during the captivity. In 2 Chronicles, we learn the beginning of that. And, of course, in Ezra and Nehemiah, we learn of the ending of that. So we see the 70-year period that's identified by Jeremiah in these Old Testament texts. In Daniel chapter 1, we've studied that and studied how that Daniel and the young men were taken captive. So with this first year of the Medo-Persian Empire, that is with Darius the Mede over Chaldea, but with Cyrus the Persian over all, the prophecy of Jeremiah was almost completed. And Daniel knew that. If you'll turn to Ezra chapter 1, reading beginning at verse 1. It says, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah the God of heaven given me. And he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whosoever there is among you of all his people, his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of Jehovah the God of Israel. He is God, which is in Jerusalem. And whosoever is left in any place where he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver, and with gold, and with goods, and with beasts, besides the freewill offering, for the house of God which is in Jerusalem." Now here Cyrus is making the decree to allow these people to go home, just as had been prophesied by Isaiah in chapter 44, the end of the chapter, and chapter 45 as it begins. Now that ought to help us to appreciate the things that the Old Testament prophets said, right down to the very year and right down to the very king that was prophesied before Cyrus was even born. By how many years? Anyone remember? About 150 years or so before Cyrus was even born, Isaiah had prophesied that Cyrus, the king of the Persians, would make a decree and allow these people to return home. And of course, in Ezra chapter 1, we're reading of its fulfillment. Now, did Daniel know about these things? Yes, he knew them from the standpoint of what Jeremiah and Isaiah had prophesied, to know that the time of the fulfillment of these Old Testament prophecies was indeed at hand. Any questions or comments just here? I think that's pretty basic or fundamental. The preparation for this prayer is interesting to me. As you look at chapter 9 once again at verse 3, "And I set my face unto the Lord God to seek by prayer and supplication with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. And I prayed unto Jehovah my God." Let's pause there. In Daniel chapter 3, or chapter 9, verse 3, we see that Daniel is making his request by prayer and supplications unto God. It tells us that he set his face toward Jerusalem. Some have suggested that that was a literal turning of his body to face the city of Jerusalem. I'm not so sure that we can come to that conclusion with any kind of degree to be dogmatic. But in the 6th chapter and in verse 11, it says, "When Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house. Now his windows were opened in his chamber toward Jerusalem, and he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime." Now you remember the context of that, where a decree had been made by Darius, as he had been prompted to make, that anyone who made any request of anyone other than Darius the king, that they were to be cast into the lion's den. And of course, it's in the 6th chapter then that we read about Daniel being cast into the lion's den because he prayed as he always did. But in this instance, it tells us that his windows were open in his chamber toward Jerusalem. I don't know if that's significant in the 9th chapter, verse 3 or not. But I do know that it is significant that he prayed with fasting, sackcloth, and ashes. What does that indicate about Daniel? Humility. Thank you. Very much humility. The physical preparations in this indicate his humility, his contrition. James tells us in James chapter 5 and in verse 16 that the prayers of a righteous man avails much. Daniel is described in this whole book as being a very righteous man. David in the Psalms, after his sin with Bathsheba and those things that were relative to that, stated in Psalms chapter 51, beginning at verse 1, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies. Blot out my transgressions, wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity, cleanse me from my sin, for I know my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me." In verse 16, we could fill in between, but specifically at verse 16, "For thou delightest not in sacrifice, else would I give it. Thou hast no pleasure in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise." So we see that humility is an essential element in acceptable prayer. If a man is to be a righteous man, he must humble himself before God. And we see that that's precisely what Daniel did. Now, you might want to notice that there are other notable characters who prayed to God and expressed the same kind of humility. I want to look in Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 1, because in this context we see during the period of the restoration, Nehemiah leading these people in the confession of their sins. Nehemiah chapter 9, beginning at verse 1. And we see this attitude of humility as they confess their sins. It says, "Now in the 24th day of this month, the children of Israel assembled with fasting and with sackcloth, and earth upon them. And the seed of Israel separated themselves from all foreigners and stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. And they stood up at the in their place and read in the book of the law of Jehovah their God a fourth part of the day." Now you'll see that likewise, I believe it's in Ezra chapter 8, I think, where they stood and listened to the law be read. Yes, yes. As he prayed to God that he would find favor before the king. That's right. And so we see an attitude of humility that becomes important to acceptable prayer. We see that in Nehemiah, as you said, chapter 1. We also see that in chapter 9 with the confession of their sins. Turn, if you will, to the book of Jonah. I think the context of this not only indicates an attitude of humility, but a lesson learned. You recall how that Jonah was sent to cry out against the city of Nineveh, and he didn't want to do that. He knew that if he cried out against the city of Nineveh, that they might repent and that God would spare them. And of course, why did Jonah not want these people of Nineveh to be spared? He knew what was going to happen. The people of Nineveh, or the city of Nineveh, what was its significance or importance? Capital of Assyria. Now we know that back in history before Babylon, that the Assyrians were a very real threat to the people of God, and Jonah saw that. And so if he did not cry out against the Assyrians, and in particular the city of Nineveh, the capital city, if he did not cry out against them, then their wickedness would continue and God would destroy them, and thus the threat against the people of God would go away. But yet we see that he learned a very valuable lesson in the belly of the great fish, as it were. And in Jonah chapter 3, reading beginning at verse 5, Jonah has a completely different attitude. It says, "And the people of Nineveh believed God, and they proclaimed a fast and put on sackcloth from the greatest of them even to the least." Now why? If you'll notice, Jonah, in the first few verses, he's no longer running away from God. Some have described this, and I think rightly so, as Jonah running to God. And we see that Jonah preached unto them the preaching of God. And what effect did it have upon the people of Nineveh? Instead of being prideful or arrogant, they appear before God in sackcloth and ashes. Yes, Joey.
Wasn't there more to it than just him having a fear of them rising up against God's people in the future? Wasn't he also basically prejudiced and biased against that nationality of people?
Well, prejudice and so forth existed very predominantly with the people of God against anybody. And I think that even bleeds over into the New Testament with the Apostle Peter not wanting to go, as we talked about Sunday morning, to the household of Cornelius. Yeah, to the Gentiles. And so, yes, to answer your question, yes. Okay. So the people of Nineveh appear before God in sackcloth and set in ashes. Again, a display of the humility on the part of those who approach God. Now, the prayer of Daniel. I like to outline things, and I think it's significant in this to see a very simple outline. A confession of sin and a plea for mercy. Two very fundamental points in the prayer of Daniel. In chapter 9, beginning at verse 4, it says, "And I prayed unto Jehovah my God, and made confession, and said, O Lord, the great and dreadful God." Let's pause right there. The great and dreadful God. It's interesting to notice that expressions such as, well, the specific expression, O Lord, expresses fervor and intensity in the prayer of Daniel. And you'll notice that the expression, O our God and O my God, occurs in this chapter, expressing great intensity in the prayer of Daniel unto a great and awesome God. There are a number of occasions, and we'll not take the time to talk about all of them, but I want to notice just a little bit of what is said about a great and awesome God. If you still have your Bible open to Nehemiah, the 9th chapter, drop down, if you will, to verse 32. Verse 32, where Nehemiah and the people have made a public confession of their sins, and they have elaborated on the specific sins that they have committed. But in verse 32, it says, "Now therefore, our God, the great and mighty and the terrible God, who keep us covenant and loving kindness, let not all the travail seem little before thee that hath come upon us, on our kings, on our princes, and on our priests, and on our prophets, and on our fathers, and on all thy people since the time of the kings of Assyria unto this day." The prophet expresses the greatness and the awesomeness of God in the judgments that God has made upon this, his people. Now, in Joshua, and of course much earlier even during the time of the children of Israel coming out of Egypt, we see God referred to in these terms. But in Joshua chapter 2, let me get to that. Joshua chapter 2, in verse 8. As the spies come into the city of Jericho, God has a reputation among his enemies. And Joshua are the enemies of the people of God. In verse 8 it says, "And before they were laid down, she came up unto them upon the roof, and she said unto the men, I know that Jehovah hath given you the land." Who are we reading about? Rahab the harlot, who hid the spies as they came in to spy out the city of Jericho. "I know that Jehovah hath given you the land, and that the fear of you is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how Jehovah dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what ye did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, unto Sihon and unto Og, whom ye utterly destroyed. And as soon as we had heard it in our hearts, or heard it, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more spirit in any man because of you. For Jehovah your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore I pray you, swear unto me by Jehovah, since I have dealt kindly with you, that ye also will deal kindly with me or with my father's house and give me a true token." Rahab the harlot in Jericho has heard of the great and mighty works that God has done. She's heard of the awesomeness of the great God who led the children of Israel up out of Egypt. Going back to our text in Daniel chapter 9. Not only do we read about the greatness of God, but it says He keepeth covenant. Now we noted that in Nehemiah chapter 9. He keepeth covenant and loving kindness with them that love Him and keep His commandments. What is a covenant? A covenant is often described as what? When you marry somebody, have you created a covenant with them? Pardon me? It's a promise. Now God has agreed to keep a promise to those who love Him and keep His commandments. He'll bless them who love Him and keep His commandments. You remember Jesus saying in John chapter 14 and verse 15, a familiar text, "If you love Me, you will keep My commandments." God is true to those who love Him and do what He says. Now that's just the simple point that Daniel is making in this prayer. He knows who he's praying to and the conditions upon which prayer will be received and answered. Furthermore, regarding Daniel's confession, in verse 5, he says, "We have sinned." Notice the term "we." Daniel is including himself and the people. "We have transgressed the commandment of God." This expression, "we have sinned," occurs another time in this book, or in this chapter, as we see in verse 15, a summarization of the things that Daniel has prayed for. Again, the statement, "we have sinned, and we have done wickedly." We have sinned. Now, since I was a little boy, which was just a few days ago, I have learned that the definition of sin means to miss the mark. And you've seen the target and the fellow that pulls back the bow and the arrow misses the target. To miss the mark is what sin means, and that's how it's defined. And so Daniel says we have missed the mark. We've committed iniquity. We've done wickedly. We're guilty of the sin of rebellion. You'll remember from Nehemiah's listing of the expression of the sins that the people of God had committed. Likewise, you'll notice in that account, rebellion. What is rebellion? If somebody tells you to do something and you rebel, what have you done? All right, you've just waved your nose up at the authority. That's right. And that's exactly what these people were guilty of. We want to notice in 2 Chronicles 36, I think is the passage that I'm looking for. That's the one I have on the board. 2 Chronicles 36. Oh, I'm not sure that's the one I'm looking for, but we'll turn to that. 2 Chronicles 36. In verse 15. No, verse 14 beginning, I believe it is. Yes, verse 14. "Moreover, all the chiefs of the priests and the people trespassed very greatly after all the abominations of the nations. And they polluted the house of Jehovah, which He had hallowed in Jerusalem. And Jehovah, the God of their fathers, sent to them by His messengers, rising up early and sending because He had compassion on His people and on His dwelling place. But they mocked the messengers of God, and despised His words, and scoffed at His prophets, until the wrath of Jehovah arose against His people, till there was no remedy." Now, those of you who are parents, you understand what this Old Testament writer is saying. You might warn and warn and warn, but ultimately there comes a time of judgment, doesn't there? There's a time when the axe falls, when the patience ends, and it's time to suffer the consequences. The writer in 2 Chronicles 36 says the time has ended. God's judgment is to come. Reading further in this text, "Therefore He brought upon them the king of the Chaldeans, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon young men, or virgin, old men, or hoary-headed. He gave them all into His hand, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of Jehovah, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these He brought to Babylon. And they burned the house of God, and brake down the wall of Jerusalem, and burnt all the palaces thereof with fire, and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried He away to Babylon. And they were the servants to Him," or they were servants to Him and His sons, "until the reign of the king a kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. That's going to be significant to us a little bit later, so underscore that. For as long as it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. Now, in this text, the writer says that even the kings, the princes, the fathers, all of these people had rebelled against God. Jeremiah becomes rather specific in a number of texts. I want to look first of all in Jeremiah chapter 6. Jeremiah chapter 6, beginning at verse 10. Now this is a text I want you to try to remember. Jeremiah chapter 6, beginning at verse 10, because it illustrates, along with Jeremiah 23, the attitude of the people in their relationship to God. In verse 10, it says, "To whom shall I speak and testify that they may hear? Behold, their ear is uncircumcised, and they cannot hearken. Behold, the word of Jehovah is become unto them a reproach. They have no delight in it." The people of God would not listen. It was not that God refused to speak to them. He spoke to them many times through the prophets, but they wouldn't listen to what the prophets said. And then at verse 11 he says, "Therefore I am full of the wrath of Jehovah. I am weary with holding in. Pour it out upon the children in the street and upon the assembly of young men together. For even the husband with the wife shall be taken, the aged with him that is full of days." Remember, that's just what we read in 2 Chronicles 36. "And their houses shall be turned unto others, their fields and their wives together. For I will stretch out my hand upon the inhabitants of the land, saith Jehovah. For from the least of them, even to the greatest of them, every one is given to covetousness." You see, even the kings, the princes, the fathers, and all the people, from the greatest to the least, were involved in this great rebellion against God. It says, "And from the prophet even unto the priest, every one dealeth falsely. They have healed also the hurt of my people slightly, saying, Peace, peace, when there is no peace." It was not that there were no prophets in the nation of Israel. There were a multitude of prophets. But there were prophets that were prophesying false things and telling the people all is well when it was not well. And look at what they're doing. They cheated, stolen, denied God, and rebelled against Him, and for personal gain. And if you'll notice in verse 15, they were not ashamed when they had committed abomination. God's fed up with them. He's disgusted with them. And so the pronounced judgment is to begin, as we see not only here, but also in 2 Chronicles. Now, in Jeremiah chapter 23, well, I forgot something. I want to go back to Jeremiah chapter 6 before you leave that. In verse 16, it says, "Thus saith Jehovah, Stand ye in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths, where is the good way, and walk therein, and ye shall find rest for your souls. But they said, We will not walk therein. And I set watchmen over you, saying, Hearken to the sound of the trumpet. But they said, We will not hearken." The people were rebellious. God had stated His will in no uncertain terms. God had told them what would come if they didn't obey Him. And they said, "We will not listen." And so judgment was coming. And God said, "It will be through the king of Babylon that such judgment will come. And you will be in captivity for 70 years before you come out." And we'll talk about the significance of the 70 years a little bit later. Turn with me, if you will, to the next passage, Jeremiah chapter 26. No, Jeremiah 23. I don't have this one on the board. Jeremiah 23, reading beginning at verse 16. Jeremiah 23, verse 16. "Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, Hearken not unto the words of the prophets that prophesy unto you. They teach you vanity. They speak a vision of their own heart, and not out of the mouth of Jehovah. They say continually unto them that despise me, Jehovah has said, Ye shall have peace. And unto every one that walketh in the stubbornness of his own heart, they say, No evil shall come upon you." The attitude of the people of God that prompts God's wrath to be poured out upon them is fascinating to me. They had people among them saying that you can do what you want to do and there will be no consequence. That runs counter to everything that God had told them since the conception of these people and even before. God had told them in Deuteronomy chapter 4, at verse 24 and 25, before they ever entered into the promised land, "If you do what I tell you to do, I'll bless you. But if you do not, if you worship and serve idols, here's what I'll do to you. Now, how many times did it take God telling them that to get the message across? That if you rebel against me, here's what I will do. And God was patient with them, and patient with them, and patient with them. But they continued to try him. And these prophets would tell them, no consequence, no evil shall come upon you. In verse 18 of Jeremiah 23, he said, for who has stood in the counsel of Jehovah that he should perceive and hear his word? Who hath marked my word and heard it? Now you remember from Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 10, God spoke to them, but they wouldn't listen. Here the question is, who has taken heed? Who will listen to what I've had to say? They will listen to the false prophets when they said, peace, peace, and there was no peace. But when God tells them, there are consequences to your sin, they wouldn't listen when God spoke, but said when the prophet appealed to them to walk in the old paths, we will not. Look at Jeremiah chapter 23, verse 28. Verse 27. Well, you might even back up to verse 26 to get the setting. It says, how long shall this be in the heart of the prophets that prophesy lies, even the prophets of the deceit of their own heart, that think to cause my people to forget my name by their dreams, which they tell every man to his neighbor, as their fathers forget my name for Baal? The prophet that hath a dream, let him tell a dream. And he that hath my word, let him speak my word faithfully. What is the straw to the wheat, saith Jehovah, and so forth. In verse 31, behold, I am against the prophets, saith Jehovah, that use their tongue and say, he saith, behold, I am against them that prophesy lying dreams, saith Jehovah, and do tell them, and cause my people to err by their lies. These people wouldn't listen. And because of the false prophets, God says, I will send my wrath upon them. Now then, Jeremiah chapter 44, or chapter 26. I've missed this one and missed it and missed it. I'm going to go and get it. Jeremiah chapter 26, verse 5. He said, to hearken unto my words, or the words of my servants, the prophets, whom I send unto you, even rising up early and sending them, but ye have not hearkened. They wouldn't listen. Jeremiah 44, Nehemiah chapter 9, and all of these, we see the expression on behalf of the people that they wouldn't listen. In Nehemiah chapter 9, I particularly want you to notice verse 32. Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 32. Nehemiah says, now therefore our God, great and mighty and terrible God, who keepest covenant and loving kindness, let not all the travail seem little before thee that hath come upon us, on our kings, on our princes. We read that a few moments ago. Don't consider the consequences of sin as a light thing. These things are to turn them from their rebellion. Now, in verse 8, let's go back to our text. Daniel chapter 9. I want to look at verse... we haven't gotten that far. Let's look at verse 5 once again. Catch ourselves up, getting ahead of myself. He says, we have sinned and have dealt perversely, and have done wickedly, and have rebelled, even turning aside from thy precepts and from thine ordinances. Neither have we hearkened unto the prophets, unto thy servants the prophets, that spake in thy name to our kings, our princes, to our fathers, and to all the people of the land. I'm persuaded that it's very significant that there is no respect of persons in the sins that they have committed. It runs from the top all the way to the bottom. If you'll turn to Amos chapter 6, you'll see this, beginning at verse 1. Amos chapter 6, verse 1. Woe unto them that are ease in Zion, to them that are secure in the mountain of Samaria, the notable men of the chief of the nations, to whom the house of Israel is come. Pass ye unto Calna and see, and from thence go ye unto Hamath the great. Then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Are they better than these kingdoms? Or is their border greater than your border? Ye that put away, or put far away the evil day, and cause the seat of violence to come near, that lie upon beds of ivory, that stretch themselves upon their couches, that eat lambs out of the flock, and the calves out of the midst of the stall. You'll notice that he's describing those who are wealthy. Here are those who are at the top of the ladder, if you please. In Amos... Oh, that's not the one I want just yet. in Ezra chapter 9. You might notice again in Ezra chapter 9, beginning at verse 6. Ezra chapter 9, in verse 6. That's the one I'm looking for. I said, O my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee. My God, for our iniquities are increased over our head, and our guiltiness is grown up unto the heavens. Now this passage, I think, just magnifies or amplifies the level of the sin that has committed or been committed from the top to the bottom. Now by way of contrast, go back, if you will, to Daniel chapter 9. Daniel chapter 9. The people have been described as very rebellious. They have sinned. But in Daniel chapter 9, beginning at verse 7, it tells us, O Lord, righteousness belongeth unto thee, but unto us confusion of face, as at this day, to the men of Judah, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and unto all Israel that are near, and that are far off, through all the countries, whether thou hast driven them. In these verses, God is described as righteous. To Judah, Israel, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem belong the shame of face, Daniel says. Both those near and far off in countries where God had driven them. Here we see the dispersion, by the way, of the people of Israel. To them, their kings, their princes, the fathers, because of their unfaithfulness against God, their sin and rebellion. To God belongs righteousness, however. To Him belongs mercy and forgiveness, even though they had rebelled against Him. God remains righteous, and because of His righteousness, judgment is to come upon this rebellious people. And so the captivity that Jeremiah had prophesied. Now, in Daniel chapter 9, pick it up, if you will, please, at verse 9. To the Lord our God belong mercy and forgiveness, for we have rebelled against Him. God is a God of mercy. But God is not a God of mercy to those who continue in rebellion. Daniel makes that plain. Judgment is to come upon these people. Because God is righteous, they will be judged according to what Jeremiah and Isaiah had forewarned. Now, the nature of their sins, I'm not going to go back to Nehemiah chapter 9 and read that whole context, but I would encourage you to, because we see a rather lengthy listing of sins that they confess. Now, why do they confess sin during this period of restoration? The law has been read, and it hasn't been read in a very long time. And when they hear the law of God read, they realize that there are responsibilities that they have that they've not implemented. They see that there are things that they've done that are contrary to the teaching of the law. And they weep and cry. And among those things in Ezra chapter 9, chapter 10 it is, you'll notice that their marriage relationships were all messed up. In Nehemiah chapter 13, they had intermarried with the heathen nations, and consequently, their children spake the language of Ashdod. So one of the things that we see in the acknowledgement of their sins is the acknowledgement that these laws came from God through the prophets, and that these laws had come a long time before, and Daniel recognizes that in 6th century B.C. They had transgressed His law. They had departed so as to not obey His voice. They had not prayed. Let's drop down in the text in verse 13, I believe it is. As it is written in the law of Moses, all this evil has come upon us, yet we have not entreated the favor of Jehovah our God. Rebellion, transgression, failure to pray. Question or comment? That's right. The people love to have it so. Yes. Yes. Randy?
We're doing a lot of page turning.
That's good.
From book to book. Yeah, that is good. But I'm trying to grasp what prophecies are parallel to each other.
Okay, Jeremiah prophesied these things prior to the captivity. Isaiah prophesied these things prior to the captivity. These are the things that Daniel is familiar with when he's praying to God. I knew these things were coming, he said.
The passage in Isaiah 6, Isaiah 6 verse 8, when I heard the Lord, I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send to rule over us?" Then I said, "Here I am, send me," and he said to me, "Don't tell those people, keep on listening, but do not perceive, keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull and their eyes dim, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return to you." Is that prophecy is pointing to this time of Daniel? Or is that prophecy?
No. Well, it could be, but you'll notice in Matthew the 15th, the 13th chapter, that Jesus quotes from this prophecy. And shows fulfillment of it even during his time. Point being is that any time God's people are addressed and they will not listen. I want to suggest to you a thought from the time of Pharaoh. You'll recognize this, that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. You'll also remember that Pharaoh hardened his own heart. When God speaks to a people and they won't listen, what ultimately happens? Hearts become hard. And Isaiah is saying, "Here am I, send me." But in this context, he describes the condition of the heart of the people in verse 9, as you read. "Go and tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not, and see ye indeed, but perceive not." This is quoted in the New Testament. But this was the very attitude that Pharaoh had. God spoke to Pharaoh and said, "Let my people go," but he didn't get it. And thus the plagues began to come upon him. Rebellion was a part of Pharaoh's attitude. Because God said, "Do this," he refused to do it. Go ahead.
So Jesus wasn't saying that Isaiah was prophesying about this particular time. Isaiah was prophesying about any generation.
I think so. I think so.
And that just happened to be another one that Jesus was speaking to another generation.
I think so. Yeah. It's applicable in any generation that refuses to listen.
It was applicable to Isaiah's generation.
That's right, and that's what led them into captivity. Now keep in mind that Isaiah prophesied about 750 years before Christ. So the application of what he had to say is to a rebellious people that would have application at any time. Okay, David, you have your hand up?
No.
Okay. David? Yes. Oh, yes. I want to look at some of these. Deuteronomy chapter 4, Deuteronomy chapter 8, Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy contains a number of warnings for this very time. Deuteronomy chapter 4, we mentioned just a moment ago, at verse 25, says, "Then shalt thou beget children and children's children, and ye shall have been long in the land, and shall corrupt yourselves, and make a graven image in the form of anything, and shall do that which is evil in the sight of Jehovah thy God, to provoke him to anger. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day. Ye shall soon utterly perish from off the land, whereunto ye go over the Jordan to possess it. Ye shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. And Jehovah will scatter you among the peoples, and ye shall be left few in number among the nations, whither Jehovah shall lead you away." God had told them these things. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, you'll notice likewise in verse 24, "And Jehovah commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear Jehovah our God for our good." That's chapter 6. Chapter 8, it's a different chapter, same place on the page, Richard. Verse 19, "And it shall be, if thou shalt forget Jehovah thy God, and walk after other gods, and serve them, and worship them, I testify against you this day, that ye shall surely perish. As the nations that Jehovah maketh to perish before you, so shall ye perish, because ye would not hearken unto the voice of Jehovah your God." So time and time and time again, God warned them. The blessings and the curses in Deuteronomy chapter 28 through 30, and in particular chapter 28, were pronounced upon them if they would do what God said, he would bless them. If they would not, they would be cursed. And that repeated over and over. Makes you wonder why they didn't get the message. Okay, you're telling me I'm out of time.
I am.
Well, that's not good. You might want to add to that Lamentations chapter 1, verse 12, chapter 2, verse 13, verse 17. We'll talk about some of these as we begin our study next time.